There once was a time in newspapers in which the comic section was capable of a little bit of danger. It may have been danger of the cross the street on a red light, or the eating your entree with a salad fork variety. Nobody truly knows if there were any lives lost, or if the taxidermists got any business during this interesting epoch. But it was danger nonetheless. Danger that was necessary when stacked against the mainstream horrors of Garfield and the Family Circus. Danger as served up by a man named Berkeley Breathed.
So I am here with Berkeley Breathed, who is the author of Mars Needs Moms and is something of a cartoonist, I hear.
Berkeley, so they say.
Yeah. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. It's a book tour, so it's tiring, but then you meet all the people that you don't see when you're drawing cartoons and drawing digital paintings inside a dark room for your whole career. So it's good for us to get out and do these things.
Is there something of a kind of disparity between you at the cartoonist table and actually knowing that, oh my God, these people all read my strip?
There is. It's a shock of a realization that there's more than just the two or three faces that you imagine as your readers of the strip as you're drawing it. I mean, often as you draw it, you're trying to figure out whether it's understandable, whether it's clear, whether it's funny, of course, who's going to be offended by it. And you kind of have these imaginary readers out there who you picture. And it's difficult to conceive of the millions of people seeing it every day. And certainly in the 80s, when I had 50 to 70 million readers, it was virtually impossible to put it in context that meant anything. Mm. And it begins to happen when you go from a city to city and you meet people and they talk about your work in ways that you don't think about it yourself.
Yeah.
And it puts it into a different kind of context, and it's good because you come back home with a renewed sense of responsibility in some ways without, you know, getting maudlin about it. You do not take it for granted sometimes, as often happens when there's a lot of deadlines and things almost become rote, and you forget that there are people waiting to read it, and that what they read they take very seriously, even in a funny way, and they process it in their lives. And it's good to be reminded of that.
Yeah, gotcha. Well, let's talk about the book here first.
Sure, yeah.
Mars Needs Moms. It tells the tale of a blonde-haired boy named Milo. Bloom County started off with a blonde-haired boy named Milo.
Yeah.
And you confess in the author's note that you have a son who is a blonde-haired boy named Milo.
I've obviously got a little problem with the Milo.
Exactly. So I'm wondering how we corral this holy trinity of blonde-haired boys named Milos. Does life imitate art? Does art influence life?
No. Well, life imitates art, but not my art. Yeah. All the Milos came from Milo in Norton Juster's Phantom Tollbooth.
Uh-huh.
It's a book written in the, you know, it has to be early 60s, but it was my first pivotal chapter book that I'd ever read that meant anything to me, and obviously it meant a lot. It was that, and To Kill a Mockingbird was sort of the instrumental literary influences of my life.
I always wondered if Portnoy the Hedgehog was related to Portnoy's Complaint, or is this the only literary kind
No, definitely not. That didn't mean anything to me. No, you'll find cultural or literary references scattered throughout the strip, but particularly To Kill a Mockingbird. It's a running joke now.
Yeah. Gotcha.
And I've got a nice letter from Harper Lee, by the way, if I can throw that in.
Yeah.
No one else has got one of those I've ever seen, so.
Yeah, so I hear. Well, you described in other interviews that the idea of a parent being willing to die or to sacrifice himself or herself for her children was something you wanted children to consider in this book. And one of your other children's books, Edward Fudwepper Fib Big, also explores the consequences of spinning lies.
Yes,
I wanted to actually ask you, do you feel that children's books should possess a social message, or is there a certain danger in being too didactic?
There's always a danger in being too didactic. You won't find any social messages in my picture books. Mm-hmm. And you won't necessarily find good lesson making either. I'm not sure I like morals in children's books because they're too obvious. I think I'm moved by moral dilemmas as opposed to morals, learning a moral. But a moral dilemma in a story and a character rising above her or himself to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And now that I think about it, that's the moments in movies that move me. And now, when you become a parent, it's all about getting beyond yourself and your own interests and doing the right thing for your kid. So that was the immediate emotional response I had to becoming a parent, and I wanted to explore it in a book. But I don't think you would come away from Marsden's mom's being able to say, like an Aesop's fable, and saying this is a life lesson for you. Mm-hmm. All it's meant to do is highlight for a child a dimension of his parent or her parent that they weren't aware of, and maybe to think about it a little bit, that they're not just discipline machines, they're not just food machines, that there's something else. They're the person, the only other person on the planet that would take a bullet for you, and you're not going to have that again, period.
When you concoct one of these children's books narratives, do you just need to have this kind of ethical construct to go along with the art? Or
what it starts with is a pivotal turning moment, and I build the rest of the story around that. You can look at each of my books, and there's an emotional turn in it somewhere. You'll find that in a good movie too. But I come from films. If I had to list influences, it would be film more than other types of entertainment or literature. And in a good film, you have any construction of a good story, there has to be that moment of truth. And it's usually tied in with an arc of a character and a flawed character at the beginning that needs to be fixed. I mean, it's classic screenwriting structure. Well, I didn't see enough of that in children's books, but that's what turns me on as a storyteller. So inevitably, you'll see that. It explains why my books get sold to the movies so quickly, because they already have that component. And most children's stories are a tough translation for filmmakers to turn into movies. They have a terrible time. Mm-hmm. Polar Express is a good example. It's an adventure without any emotional arc to the story. The character doesn't start off with a problem. Nothing gets solved. There's no resolution. And when it came time to turn it into a movie, the writers had to go back and start all over again and invent. And in this case, they may not have put too much into it, but they needed to come up with at least some emotional story. A narrative without an emotional story leaves me totally bored, and that's why my books don't have that. You can find about page 28, you should be approaching that moment of truth. And
exactly,
will the
page 28?
I could point it out in a screenplay, yeah, where it needs to come in the movie. Mm-hmm. But in any good story, in any good book, it should come about three quarters of the way through. Mm-hmm. And that's what you'd see in Marsden's Mom.
Sure. I wanted to also ask you about the details that are in this book, as well as your cartoons, as well as your other books. For example, there's lots of background details in this. You have the picture with basically the vegetables, and you have all of the Japanese illustrations of all the Japanese paintings are looking down directly. You have also, like, you know, the dog extending his tongue for the spilled tomato sauce.
You know, I do that because I'm now reading my stories to my kids, uh-huh, and for the first time, I've watched a child looking at a book. I wrote my other books without ever having a child on my lap reading the books too. Mm-hmm. So I didn't see how they looked at the pictures. One lesson I immediately took was, when you say Milo turned toward the wall and saw a frog, you better darn well show the frog on the wall in the book. Otherwise, he stops the story and goes, "Dad, where's the frog?"
Yeah.
But I said, it's not that important to the story. They just mentioned there's a frog. Where's the frog, Dad? He's behind the wall. No, I want to see the frog, Dad. So you learn those things. You learn that they're looking at the details. And an illustrator who leaves those details out does it at his peril. So in each painting, I want something there for a kid to find as a little hook to pull them into it. For instance, one of the paintings has the spaceship landing outside the window while Milo is fast asleep on his bed and the dog is tucked up underneath his bottom.
Yeah. Well, one eye there.
Open. Yeah, the one eye was added later. I'd done the entire painting without the dog or any of the characters awake. And it was missing that little fun detail for the kid to discover in each painting. And so I went in there, and you can do this digitally now. I had one eye open. Mm-hmm. And that was the whole energy of that painting, was the dog's awake. The dog knows. And the kid loves finding that each time. He doesn't even know he's doing it. It's a subliminal thing. You should find that in each of my paintings. And if not, I've fallen down.
Well, except for the last couple, you know, the end of the book, where it's you just want to portray this human moment, I would say.
Yeah. Although I added the dad at the end. There was Milo in his arms, in mom's arms, in bed, in the morning, and I'd shown the book to my kids, which is very rare that I do that. It's very dangerous to show a kid a work in progress to your kid because you've invested them with way too much power.
Yeah.
So if somebody said something critical if my kid says something critical, I may overemphasize the worth of that comment and change it. So I typically don't show the kids this, but I did this time just as a run through, and sure enough, both of my kids wanted to know where Dad was in the story. Mm-hmm. Was Dad dead? Was Dad grabbed by the Martians and we don't see it? And I realized once again I failed to think of the story through the child's perspective. They want to know. They want to be comforted. Where is Dad?
Yeah.
Now I could say, Dad's not there. It's just family with Mom, which is fine. But they want to have that explained. They don't want to guess about it. So I drew Dad into the last painting. Just before I handed it in to the publisher, explained that Dad's been asleep the entire time, but he was in bed, and he's up, and he doesn't know a darn thing. And in a way, that's the little hook in the picture, that this whole story has happened, and Dad's just yawning, oblivious, like dads often are.
Yeah, gotcha. Well, do you need to have a sort of detail in every sort of illustration or strip that you do? Is this a way to amuse yourself, or to at least amuse the reader?
No, it's rewarding the reader for coming along on the journey, and I guess I'm saying that I've taken the time to put a little something in each painting to merit your time and attention to it. There's too many picture books I've read to my kids where there's nothing surprising, and maybe that's the element I'm adding. It's a little bit of a surprise for the mm-hmm. child to find. There's a picture of the aliens fishing for moms, trying to attract a mom. Well, I could have used many things for them to be fishing with, but they're fishing with a mocha or a latte from Starbucks.
Or it could be anything, really. Use your imagination.
Well,
all we have is a Starbucks cup.
It's true. Who knows what's in there? But let the kids wander. and then on the wall, might have just been a brick wall, but instead of brick wall, I had an old faded advertisement for Mother's Pies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bring a little mom home with you. Well, what's the expression? Foretelling.
Do you need the book?
No, I'm just saying it's a literary term. When you're giving the clue as to where you're going in the story ahead of time.
Oh, the kind of telling detail.
Yeah, it's
foreshadowing.
It's foreshadowing. That's the word. We don't typically apply to children's literature too much, but in this case, I love doing that. So the next time the kid reads the book, he sees that. Just like you'd see a good movie when they've been using foreshadowing correctly. Mm-hmm. You go back and go, oh, now I didn't. I need to check this thing out even more carefully this time. Mm-hmm. And you increase the level of attention for the second reading of the book, which is tough to do.
The thing about these details, however, is that in your work has a very striking personality to it. Is there a sort of danger sometimes that inserting a detail like this might, I guess, call attention to, you know, this particular detail over another, you know, major kind of story that's going on? What steps do you take to kind of ensure that these stay in the foreground?
Well, what you're talking about is keeping it organic. As long as the details help and move the story along, it's the same thing you want to do in a film, and you also want to avoid in doing a film when you do it poorly, which is add extraneous details just because they're funny. Mm-hmm. That's a huge mistake. To have a character say a gag or say a funny line that you can't resist because it's funny, but having that out of character for that character to say is a classic mistake in screenwriting. Mm-hmm. That stops the story. That slows the story. You think it's being entertaining, but actually anything that is contradictory to the forward movement of the narratives, no matter how funny it is, still works against the story. Mm-hmm. So those details I just described in the paintings, if they were there just for a laugh, and they didn't pertain to the dog with one eye open. It's one eye open because he's hearing the one thing that Milo's not hearing,
yeah.
And that's the very thing that's going to move the story forward. I can't have the dog off in the corner doing something silly. It has nothing to do with the fact that the Martians are landing. But I might have thought of something funny for that dog to be doing in the corner. Now, I might have done that in the early years of drawing. But the discipline of screenwriting steers you towards thinking organically about all the action, all the pictures, all the words, all have to be working together to move that story forward. And if it doesn't move the story forward, cut it out.
Was there a time during your career where you realized that you actually had a complete command of this?
Well, who knows if I have a command of it or not?
Yeah.
I'm trying. It's a practice. It's a discipline. But is there a point where I thought that I could do it?
Yeah, maybe that's probably a better question.
It's all learning. If you show me that my first couple of picture books, I would say, look, this is riddled with mistakes, yeah. obvious mistakes. Biggest one being it's overwritten. My early books are way too long. One of the ones that people like the most is Red Ranger Came Calling, a few books back. It's hopelessly too long. Now, people love it, but I'm tempted to re-release it completely rewritten so that it's got at least 70% less copy, less words. And I think that's extremely important in children's books to keep them short.
Now all of the illustrations in this were done digitally.
This time they were, for the first time.
And I wanted to actually ask you about that, because I know that when you started out Opus, you actually used coloring through Photoshop. Do you feel that you've lost anything by doing it digitally, or is there any kind of component of maybe drawing it out before?
That sounds like you're suggesting I may have lost something.
No. I mean, you know, or gained something. I'm so sorry.
Well, it definitely gained something.
Yeah.
I would not have moved digitally if I didn't happen, really coincidentally, to draw or to paint in the one style that is wholly conducive to digital paint, to reproducing in digital painting.
Oh, okay.
That virtually you can't tell, and that's airbrushing.
Yeah.
I airbrush because I don't know how to paint. It's a complete fraudulent cheat of true painting.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to paint all of my books in oils. It would take me 2 years to do a painting, to do a book. But I would love to do it that way. I love the look of oils. I can't do it. I don't have the time to learn. I've got about 200 stories in my head that I need to pump out there just to get them on paper. As any storyteller can tell you, they're no good unless they're down on paper. It takes a long time to paint a picture book. You can almost write a short novel faster than you can do these. Digitally, it speeds the process up 200%. So I can do a picture book in 2.5 months when it would have taken me nearly a year to do it in airbrushing. So that's why I do it, but only because you've very difficult to tell my digital painting from my old airbrushing.
Gotcha. I actually wanted to ask you about some of your colors. You're very fond of using pink and purple, and I was just really kind of curious about
this. I haven't thought about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's there in Outland and in Opus.
Really?
And in a lot of your... Even the aliens in this, the color of jelly beans, pink and purple are there. There was the purple of the sister tainting. I have to ask you about this because it's a very unusual set of colors.
Total ignorance of it. I have to go back and look at my color palette and see. The interesting thing is the next book I'm working on now, I've gone into all the paintings I've done. I've done about a dozen paintings and gotten into Photoshop and completely removed all the dynamic colors. So it's all muted now.
Mm-hmm.
And primarily because I may have subliminally noticed that I keep going back to similar colors and they're probably a bit brighter than they should be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're working digitally, you've got all this intense hues to choose from, and so it's like candy. You just, there's a bright purple, and you know, it's almost nothing you can reproduce in inks, but digitally it's bright and it's glowing on screen, so you throw it in there and you end up with, you know, maybe a set of paintings that are just too bright, just too vivid. And when you think about color used carefully in film and the great painters, they didn't paint in those bright colors. They painted in very muted colors. And I think it works more subliminally on you, the power of an image, when you're not distracted by bright colors. So it's kind of a recent conclusion of mine. So I've gone into all my paintings and just clicked on intensity of hue and just brought it way back down,
All
just shy of black and white. And been surprised at how suddenly I like them all over again, even more.
Really? So it's like almost kind of chiaroscuro kind of...
A bit,
colors, yeah.
Yeah. But just reinventing my look, which it was probably time to do.
Oh, okay. I mean, well, how did you arrive at the color palette that you're now using in these children's books and in Opus? Is it complete serendipity?
Well, it wasn't by plan, yeah. Nothing in my career has ever been... affected by an ounce of conscientiousness. So everything is by seat of the pants. If I'm using a color palette, it's just because that's what I've been reaching for.
I'm wondering if there's any specific painters or other
illustrations. Are there references for the color?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, well, here's what's interesting is that the only reason I came to picture books at all was because I stumbled on Chris Van Allsburg's Jumanji. Now, he did Polar Express.
Yeah.
And several other famous books. He's incredibly muted. He used to use only black pencil.
Mm-hmm.
So So the images that attracted me to the entire medium, of all things, were black and white. I'm actually not attracted towards bright colors in any paintings that I would put on my wall, or the art that I'm normally drawn to. I love Thomas Eakins. I love Church. I love the great landscape artists. And these folks were all painting with muted tones. So I think it's probably what I'm saying just now is that I'm just leaving my adolescence of painting, mm-hmm. and being a little bit more mature about it, and scaling back on my usual bad instincts with color to a tonality range that maybe is more mature. If I don't want to be too pretentious about it, but you know, we're painters. We eventually end up sounding pretentious no matter how we talk about it.
Yeah, I got you. Well, I'm wondering if all the films that you've consumed over the years have been a sort of visual influence.
I tell you, I'm noticing color now more, and that's probably because I'm taking painting seriously. For instance, 300. Mm-hmm. Did you see that?
Haven't seen it yet. I've been wanting to.
Have you seen the? I've seen the trailers.
I've read the Frank Miller comic, and I've seen the trailers.
Almost too conscientiously careful in how they colored this movie. I mean, they've left reds, but they brought all the other colors down almost to duotones of browns and whites and such. So it's cool, but it's also an example of you pay too much attention, you draw too much attention to your palette, then it stops working subliminally, which is how color should work,
yeah.
and starts like waving its flag, and aren't I cool? Don't I look different?
Yeah.
And you don't want to do that, so...
Did you sort of, I guess, have you moved away? Did you initially, when you were starting out using colors, try to basically be, hey, here I am, or have you kind of gotten that out of your system?
Well, what you're doing wrong is you're using the word try in your question. I wasn't trying to do anything. When I was doing my first comic, I wasn't trying to do anything. I wasn't looking for a benchmark to hit. I wasn't looking for an audience. I wasn't trying to be the funniest guy on the page. There was the paper. There was the pen. Mm-hmm. I thought of something funny. I put it in a cartoon. I sent it in. So there was no trying involved. I just did it. It sounded like Yoda. Do not try. Just do. And that's all I did. I just did. So, and I'm painting the same way. I don't think about it in advance enough to even... and I'm not saying this is a virtue.
Yeah.
It just doesn't come to me naturally to think about things too much before I do them, which is not necessarily a good thing. As I said, I've got my first several children's books sitting there filled with artistic mistakes that should have been spotted earlier. But then, as I've never been conscientious about one thing in my career, why would I start now? So I usually get delayed by book 7 or 8. I'm taking color seriously, as we're discussing. And I'll probably slip into a comfortable style, color in a color fashion that I really like, and then that becomes my signature. I don't think that's happened yet.
But there are virtues of instant production. Here you are being able to see where you're improving, what mistakes you're making, and how to get better as an artist.
Yeah.
And you're also staying busy, and you're actually keeping your hands busy. So.
Well, there's something to be said for digital art, because it speeds the process up. Each thing you do, you're looking at it and you're reviewing and you get better. If you only produce, 5 children's books in 10 years, that's not a lot of opportunities for you to self-edit and get better. Mm-hmm. My first year of cartooning, I went from barely able to draw a human character in line and barely able to print legibly, to within 3 months completely revamping the look and feel and getting good enough to look approachably professional. But that's only because you're cartooning every single day.
Yeah.
Every day you get incrementally better. As a painter, I can't imagine, if you're only doing a couple paintings a year, you're just not going to get better.
Yeah.
So digital painting allows me to do 3 books. And 3 books from now, I'll probably look back on the one now and can't imagine why I was so stupid.
I'm wondering, though, about this procrastination impulse of yours. You've described to other people...
Pretty much past that.
Okay.
It went with youth, to tell you the truth. Middle age brought on, finally, a bit of maturity applied to the profession. I mean, I extended adolescence, extended for me, into damn near 40, which meant chasing the FedEx truck down the street every bloody deadline, you know, which is every week. Or worse, getting on the plane to finish the cartoons at the end of the week and giving them to a cab driver in Washington, D.C., telling him to deliver it to the Washington Post, getting back on the plane and going home.
But I'm wondering why. No one has asked you why you waited to the last minute.
A psychologist would have to explain. I could not physically. And I had 10 years every day to do it. I never didn't get the strips. I never did the strips early enough to actually put them in just a FedEx box. That was expensive in itself. Every single shipment was put on an airplane at 5 o'clock in the morning as cargo.
Yeah.
And to get delivered 2 hours later in Washington, D.C. And that cost about $100.
Yeah.
That was costing me $100 a week. That was times 52. In those days, that was a lot of money. I was paying this massive premium, and also I was getting penalized for being late by the syndicate.
Yeah.
It cost me tens of thousands of dollars a year because I couldn't work just 6 hours earlier.
Yeah.
And I can't explain why I couldn't put the pen to paper at 9 o'clock in the morning rather than finally at 11 o'clock that night. That's when I started doing the six cartoons the week needed. And I did those six in about 9 hours or 8 hours, which is ridiculous. Anybody who's done that would tell you. So but in the middle of drawing a cartoon, I already had to be writing in my head the next cartoon.
Yeah.
And I didn't have 5 minutes between the two the inking of the cartoons to sit around. I couldn't even get a bowl of cereal. I had to get around. And I would get so tired, I'd lay on the floor and take like a 2 minute nap. And I set the timer on for 2 minutes because I couldn't keep my eyes open. And I discovered that if you could take a 2 minute nap, it gets you going for another half an hour. And this is not a way a professional works. And you're sowing so much bad karma, it is a miracle that Bloom County, one, ever got into the newspapers, and two, was ever a success.
Yeah.
So all I can conclude is that in some twisted, bad, evil fashion, my horrendous lack of responsibility professionally somehow made the strip what it was. That lack of overthinking, maybe. Mm-hmm. Is this really a funny joke? Let me think about it for a couple of hours. Let me rewrite it again. Let me test it on some people. Let me show it to my dog. That luxury of time of editing yourself, I didn't have at all. So everything just flew out as soon as I thought of it. And maybe that's what gave Bloom County that attitude that worked in 1982. It wouldn't work now, but it might explain 1982. Which, the comic page needed that.
Yeah.
He needed someone who looked like he was being really smart about it and was calculatingly offensive to the conventional way of doing things.
Yeah.
The strip needed it. The page looked like it needed some smartass to come on and like grip it by its throat and shake it, and saying, "I'm to hell with the rules. We're reinventing what you do in a comic strip." Again, it wouldn't work now because reinventing everything is endemic. Stretching boundaries and stretching envelopes is happening so fast in all mediums that anybody doing it now, it's hardly going to make a stir. 1982, on a comic page ruled by Garfield, it was very easy. But maybe that lack of conscientious maturity applied to my craft actually allowed the in-your-face attitude that the kids love the strip for.
Well, I should also point out that you're working in two mediums here, the children's book and kind of mainstream newspaper comics that have, you know, basically people sort of shaking their fingers in this kind of Calvinistic zeal about what is right for family audiences like. And do you think that these kinds of restrictions help you as an artist? Or, I mean, these kinds of, like, you can't do that.
Well, certainly the rules are different on the comic page, but, you know, in a funny way, children's literature has got a more rigid orthodoxy than the comic page ever did. I mean, we have plenty of limitations on comic pages, and we accepted and we knew what they are. The ones I broke tended not to be the obvious ones about sex and bad words and that kind of thing. It was style. It was structure and form. The comic character had never turned around on the comic page in 1982 and talked to the audience.
Yeah.
It may have. I don't remember ever happening, certainly not consistently. And it didn't occur to me that I didn't know enough about the comic business to know that that was unusual or that I was breaking the this third wall of reality that no one ever normally does. But when my character turned around and tried to sell a cat, to sell merchandise to compete with Garfield down the page, I didn't realize, one, how threatening it was to editors, and two, how kids were waiting for that kind of attitude to exploit. It's all over now, but it wasn't then.
Well, there's the Outland comic in which you have the characters all sitting on the couch, and that apparently got dropped by 6 newspapers because you dared to point out this kind of sexist impulse in society that was...
Well, we knew that was going to cause a problem. We did lose 6 newspapers, but that's been reproduced more times than any one image that I've ever done. And what I like is that it didn't involve a bad word, didn't involve nudity, didn't involve the obvious thing. It just had my characters looking in their shorts.
Yeah.
And
that apparently was threatening for comics.
It was plenty threatening for the comics. And I could not do that today, by the way.
Wow, really?
No way. No, the papers are terrified.
Really?
The fear has overwhelmed the newspaper business, and that's like we're the canaries in the coal mine. The first people they get panicky about is the humor on the comic page.
Has this affected things for Opus? Or?
No, because I know where the rules are, and the days of taking the newspaper or taking the comic page and shaking it by its neck are over.
Really?
It's
hopeless, or?
It's, as far as that's concerned, it's hopeless because those days are gone. The leverage we had to do that, the power that I had to get away with it, was that I had a huge number of young readers reading the strip. A lot of eyeballs. And the newspapers knew that. And they wanted those young readers there. And they wanted them to stay there. Mm-hmm. They were already feeling the pressure of them going, but they're gone now. So there's very few people under the age of 30. This is a generalization, but it's relatively true. Very few people under 30 are reading a paper. Nobody under 20. I mean, virtually, the polls show that kids today are not growing up with a tradition of opening up a newspaper and reading it, even just for the comics. They're raised with the tradition of opening their computer or reading MySpace. So the traditions have changed. Generations are coming now with no historical knowledge, no cultural knowledge of, no growing up reading papers and having a love for them that they move into their later years with. So there's nothing behind the generation now reading the papers. There's a vacuum, and the papers are terrified. They don't know what form they're going to be in 10 years.
Yeah.
Not 25 years. They don't know where they're going to be in 10 years. What they do know is that if they exist, the average age is going to be even more than it is now, and right now it's 58.
Yeah.
It's the average age. In 1982, it was probably 38. And there were plenty of young readers. I mean, when I drew Opus the first time, by the end of the week, I had thousands and thousands of pieces of mail from basically kids and teenagers who were waiting for whatever kind of attitude was expressed in this character. The response was immediate. They're gone now. There's no one to write those letters now. So they're the leverage that gave us the power to stretch those envelopes, to test the limits of the rules, to piss off the editors, but protect against their recriminations. They're happily recriminate now. They would let us know in a second. If I drew the strip with the characters peeking in their shorts and making a comment, they wouldn't even ask us. I'd be off the page.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And
but one might also argue that the newspapers are deliberately kind of, making themselves obsolete by not catering with
it's a perfect storm. They're going down the drain and they're going in circles. In a way, you can't blame them. We hoped we could make a case. When Opus came back, basically we told the editors, look, you need to bring Opus back and put it in your papers and try to lure young readers back again. Do all these other things. Completely revamp how you show the news. Revamp your entertainment sections. Revamp how you think of comics. Let's get rid of the comic page. Look what kids are reading now, still printed on squash trees. They're still reading comic books. They're not reading the comic page. What are they getting out of graphic novels and comic books that they're not getting out of the comic page? Bring those artists to the newspaper. Forget about and reruns of Peanuts. what other graphic entertainment can we deliver that's going to lure the readers away from what they're already reading? Problem is, the people you're talking to are all 60 to 70 years old running the papers now. And what they would say is, the minute we do that, we'll really lose the people we still have. Mm. And they're terrified of losing any more of their circulation. Because every circulation number is going down.
Yeah.
Nothing is going up. And the last people reading are middle-aged people and considerably older than that.
Yeah.
So they know they need to be bringing young readers, but not at the expense of offending readers they still have.